This is the Left Pod.
Hello and welcome to the Learn English Football Podcast with your hosts, Tim and...
Tom. Hello, Tim. How are you?
I'm on top of the world today, actually, Tom. I've had a great weekend. What about you?
It's been a good weekend for me as well, but perhaps not quite as good as your one, because we didn't beat the treble winners this weekend. I think that might be what you're referring to, Arsenal's 1-0 victory over Manchester City. Am I right?
You are certainly referring to that, but don't do yourself a disservice, Tom. You drew with the richest club in the world. So not bad. So let's jump straight in, Tom. We've got a lot to cover on the Learn English Football Podcast today. We're going to talk about the top of the table clash between Arsenal at home to Manchester City. We've got West Ham, Newcastle to cover. We're going to dive into some positive results for both Manchester United and Chelsea and ask the question if this could be the turning point in their season. And Tom, as is becoming all too common on not just our podcast, but on all football conversations, a conversation about VAR. So I'm sure you're looking forward to it. Let's jump straight in. Tom, Arsenal-Manchester City. The last time Arsenal won against Manchester City was 2015. It's been a long, long, long time. It's been a lot of depressing results. I think we got a draw in that time and we felt quite proud. I went to a match where Arsenal lost by one goal on New Year's Day 2 years ago, and a lot of the fans left the stadium quite proud that we'd lost by only one goal. And that kind of mentality, Tom, has been the problem. We've had it in our heads that Manchester City are unbeatable and are streets ahead of us. And when I say streets ahead of us, I mean a lot better than us. But Tom, this was a different game. Manchester City had some absences, no Kevin De Bruyne, no Rodri, but they weren't the only ones with absences. Arsenal, of course, were missing Bukayo Saka for the first time in 180 Premier League games. He hasn't started, the Premier League outfield player holding that record. And of course, Thomas Partey, who was one of the bedrocks of the midfield last season. So going into the match, when I saw the Manchester City midfield, I did have a bit of hope, seeing Rico Williams, Kovacic...
Rico Lewis, and
Kovacic and Bernardo Silva in the middle. And I thought, we're going to be stronger and bigger than them with players like Declan Rice and Havertz, and also more controlled and experienced with players like Jorginho. And having said all that, Tom, the match started exactly how I thought it would, with City dominating and nearly scoring. And I thought at this point, oh, it's just another game between Arsenal and Manchester City. But Arsenal actually did a good job of killing the game. Tom, I don't know if you watched the game. Actually, I think you did watch the game. And as a non-Arsenal or Manchester City fan, did you think it was quite a boring game?
Yes, well, I caught the first half of the game, and after a couple of shaky, wobbly moments from your controversial number one goalkeeper, Raya, who has, I think a lot of Arsenal fans in the stands were demanding Aaron Ramsdale come back into goal after he nearly put his foot in it, an expression meaning he nearly made a goalkeeper howler and conceded the first goal. Arsenal stabilized things, actually, and the game did become a bit boring. I didn't watch the second half. My father did. He said it was quite a boring game. So in some ways, you could argue that it was Pep against his protege, Mikel Arteta, and a tactical stalemate resulted in that result, that kind of game.
Yeah, well, the fact that your father rightly said, like many other fans did, that it was on the face of it, a boring game, makes me quite proud, because that means Arsenal were able to stop Manchester City playing their free-flowing football that they always manage to play against us. They always manage to find positions on the pitch where they can dominate the ball and dictate play. And Arsenal were able to stop that. I think actually it might have been better for Manchester City if they'd played with Haaland. But I was looking on the pitch and I couldn't see him anywhere. And then I looked in William Saliba's back pocket and I saw a Haaland-shaped form sticking out of his back pocket. Tom, when somebody says, when a defender says they had the striker in their back pocket or in their pocket, what does that mean, Tom?
It means that they were in control of their opponent. It meant that their opponent didn't have any opportunities to beat the defender who was against them.
Yeah, well, just the stats do back up this, Tom. It's not just me talking with my Arsenal cap on. Haaland had an XG of 0.00, meaning he didn't have a shot, which is only the second time he's gone a whole match without a shot since he joined Manchester City a season and a bit ago now. So it's a massive congratulations to the Arsenal defence and especially to William Saliba, who is really class. But also more than that, Declan Rice in midfield, he made a goal line clearance in the first half. And in the second half, he tracked back to make a tackle. It was the kind of tackle where the statistics won't do it justice because it will just look like he regained possession one time. But he didn't. He changed the atmosphere of the match with that tackle. He came from behind this Manchester City player who was running towards the Arsenal penalty area and managed to wrap a leg round where nobody else would have been able to do anything but foul and take a yellow card and emerge with the ball and start an attack the other way. He was absolutely brilliant. And of course, Gabriel Martinelli, he only came on at half time, but he was Arsenal's most dangerous player. He scored the goal via Nathan Ake's face, but he was direct, he was passionate, he was basically a defender's nightmare, playing in all those sorts of half areas, off the shoulder of the defender, basically being a total nightmare. But I think from Manchester City's point of view, they will be disappointed. I don't think it's crisis point for Manchester City. As Pep Guardiola explained after the match, they were 8 points behind Arsenal last season in April, March time of year. So being 2 points behind us in October won't be of great worry. But Tom, I do need to ask the question. Is there a more important player to Manchester City than Rodri? Because we've seen them lose Kevin De Bruyne and keep playing well. We can imagine them losing Haaland and playing Julian Alvarez in that position and playing well, or even a false nine. But without Rodri, Tom, they've now lost twice in two consecutive games in the Premier League. I believe they lost in the Carling Cup without him as well.
Against Newcastle United, that's
against
true.
Newcastle, and they won in the Champions League. Oh, but of course, he was playing in the Champions League. So, Tom, he's missed three domestic games, and they've lost all three of them. So is there a more important player to Manchester City and the way they play than the Spanish captain, Rodri? What do you think?
I do think Rodri is a fantastic player. He did score, I think, the winning goal or in the Champions League final has been immense for them for the last few seasons. But I think your question is more connected to the strength in depth of the Manchester City squad. In the past, in Rodri's absence in that position, they'd have had players of the quality of Fernandinho or Yaya Toure even to step in. Now they're dependent on a teenager. I don't know if Rico Lewis is 18 or 19 years old. He looks promising, but obviously he's very inexperienced. And Mateo Kovacic, who is experienced, but actually had a very poor game. And, you know, I'm sure you want to mention that he should have been sent off, if not once, then twice.
Well, Tom, going point by point, let's talk about the midfield situation. I actually think Pep Guardiola's dug himself a bit of a hole here because they spent big money. They paid Leeds a lot of money for Kelvin Phillips. Kelvin Phillips looks on paper to be the natural substitute for Rodri. But even over these three games, he can't get a minute. Pep Guardiola obviously doesn't fancy him. I've read reports that he doesn't trust him with his back. Well, when he's facing his own goalkeeper, receiving short passes with his back to the game, Guardiola doesn't trust that he has an image of what's happening behind him. And of course, that is a vital thing to have in that position and something Rodri definitely has in abundance. But also, I think he overcomplicated it. He overcompensated for the absence of Rodri. You think of Kovacic playing his best football, you think it's more as a number eight, not as a number six holding midfield. And then Rico Lewis was asked to do the job against Arsenal. But I noticed a few times that when Manchester City were constructing play, they were constructing play through Bernardo Silva, who had dropped into the Rodri position and was playing the Rodri role. And you could see Rico Lewis alongside him looking a bit lost, thinking, hang on a second, I'm on the pitch to play this position. Why are you in my areas? If you're in my areas, where should I be? And it kind of makes me think that Guardiola sent Rico Lewis out there to say, play in the Rodri position, but he's also gone out to Bernardo Silva and said, look, I trust your technical ability. I trust your vision of the game. You get involved and try and do the Rodri business too. So I think in some ways they had three players not doing the job, which one player normally does. Anyway, Tom, I don't want to go over the Kovacic red card too much, because at the time I was angry, I was fuming, I was livid, I was raging, I was pulling my hair out, my blood was boiling. But we won, Tom. And if they'd had 10 men, that would have been an excuse for Guardiola to say, you know, we lost because we had 10 men. And I'd much rather beat an 11-man Manchester City than a 10-man Manchester City. And let's not forget, if that red card had been a red card, it could have been 3 or 4 nil. And we don't want to see the champions embarrassed now, do we, Tom? No, obviously, just joking. It was a terrible decision. The first card, the first foul, I thought was a red card. It was studs showing. He didn't get any of the ball at the point of contact. Neither of his feet were on the ground. He was totally out of control of his momentum. I'm comparing it to the Curtis Jones tackle last week, which was reviewed by VAR and recommended to make a red card. I thought there was less control over the momentum and more impact went through the standing foot of Martin Odegaard than went through the foot of the Tottenham player. Was it Bissouma last week? So that I thought should have been a red card. And I think it's a big problem. We'll come to the big problem later with VAR, but consistency. I think essentially the VAR bottled it, and to bottle it, as you know, Tom, means to lose strength of decision making, to lose strength of bravery at the vital time. And I think probably the VAR was under pressure to keep 11 players on the pitch to try and maintain the show, the spectacle. But at the end of the day, it was the wrong decision, and the integrity of the game suffered. And then the second one, Tom, it was just one of those tackles that you've played football all these years. You've watched football. So have I. You see certain tackles and you just know that's a yellow card. That's a yellow card. It's like when you throw the ball away. You just know it's a yellow card. It's like when you pull a shirt when the player's gone past you and you're not going to get there. You know it's a yellow card. Well, how Kovacic got away without the yellow card here, I think it was the referee bottling it. And probably for the same reasons. The VAR were under pressure to keep 11 players on the pitch for both sides. And the referee felt the same pressure. But all in all, Tom, it was a disgrace. And I think some of the safety measures that we can put into VAR could have solved it. So we'll come to that later. But Tom, moving on to what must have been a very exciting match for you, because going into the match, both teams on the back of success in Europe in midweek, some tired legs. So the manager having to be a bit of creativity. Tell me all about West Ham Newcastle.
Well, it was a delightful start for us. I must admit, the West Ham fans were worried. This game, this fixture last season, we lost at home 5-2 in the end. We conceded 5 goals. So we knew how dangerous Newcastle were. We knew how they'd beaten our team with many of the same players. But this time we started fantastically. We scored after with 7 minutes on the clock. It was just a nice bit of combination play between Emerson, Paqueta, and Suchek to provide the finishing touch. Nick Pope did make a mistake coming off his line, and Emerson made a wonderful first touch to take it round him and put it on a plate for Suchek. To put it on a plate means he put a cross onto him in a position where he couldn't miss. So it was a delightful start, and we held on to the lead until halftime. But as soon as the second half, Newcastle came out, they were a different team. They worked their way back into the game. I have to say, for me, the standout player in that team, and there are many, is just Kieran Trippier. I feel defensively He's brilliant, but in attack as well, he's also so crucial to that team because of his pinpoint passing and crossing. He's got such accurate delivery. He's got such great composure on the ball. He was the one who played a lovely volley pass across to, again, put it on the plate for Alexander Isak to score his second goal, put Newcastle ahead with two quick goals in the second half. And at that point, it really didn't look very good for West Ham. Not only were Newcastle firing on all cylinders, meaning that they were playing very well, they were able to work the ball up the field from the defence through the midfield very comfortably. But at West Ham were starved of possession. West Ham were struggling. And then David Moyes made an impact substitution, the player being Mohamed Kudus. The West Ham fans were excited. We know what a talent he is. When Kudus came on, we saw immediately that everything he did was excellent. We became competitive in winning the second balls again. You know, what was interesting is the contrast in tactics. Newcastle can work the ball up with passes. West Ham are reliant on aerial balls, where it's a 50-50 battle, and then you need to win the second ball. When Kudus came on, we had a player who was fast enough and with great anticipation to start winning the second balls. So it actually wasn't a surprise when he scored the goal. It was not an easy cross to control from Soufal. The ball came at him fast, but his first touch was perfect. He was coming under pressure as he shot, but he drilled it very, very hard, leaving the goalkeeper no chance. West Ham were, the stadium went wild. And then actually we even had a chance late on where we could have won the game. Having said that, I think Newcastle as well could have won the game. So on balance, 1 point each was probably a fair result. Psychologically, that was crucial for West Ham to know that they have a team of players who can compete and come away with an even score against this Newcastle team who, let's face it, they're banging form, Tim. You know, they are a team who have beaten Brentford, Sheffield United 8-0, Burnley and Paris Saint-Germain, four wins on the bounce. So West Ham were very happy.
Yeah, Tom, they were flying coming into the game. I mean, they made mincemeat of Paris Saint-Germain. It was an embarrassment what they did to them. So it was a great result for West Ham. And West Ham, seventh in the table, 3 points off fourth place. What are your ambitions for the season, Tom? West Ham have started the season, I think, better than you might have hoped. And I was having a conversation yesterday, and my question is, how many teams could finish in the top five of the Premier League? And I am going to argue, Tom, that it is 10 teams. I think 10 teams could potentially sneak a top five place. If we're looking at the Premier League table now, we've got Tottenham top on goals scored, Arsenal there as well, City, Liverpool, Villa, Brighton, West Ham, Newcastle, Crystal Palace in ninth. They are the team that I don't think could finish in the top five. However, you've got Manchester United in 10th and Chelsea in 11th. And I think Chelsea and Manchester United have both still got the quality on the pitch to put together a run of results. So, Tom, it does look like five teams are going to qualify for the Champions League next season. Could this be one of the most exciting races for the Champions League in the history of the Premier League, do you think, possibly?
It could be. It will really depend how the season plays out with injuries and European campaigns. This is where we'll see how much strength in depth do Aston Villa, Brighton, West Ham and Newcastle all have. Last season, West Ham suffered a lot despite having an excellent European campaign. This season, if you ask me how will West Ham do back in August, I would have told you I'm not very confident, Tim. But that's because we were still sitting on that £105 million Declan Rice money and we'd not bought anyone decent. But within a couple of weeks, suddenly the transfers came. Edson Alvarez, James Ward-Prowse and then Mohamed Kudus. So I'm glad Declan Rice is performing for you, Arsenal, at Arsenal, because at West Ham, we're delighted with the three players we've bought with the money. And I think we've got a great chance of qualifying for Europe again.
Nice. Yeah, it was a win-win-win situation, wasn't it, that deal? Mm-hmm. Tom, let's move on quickly to talk about Brighton-Liverpool, just because it was an exciting match between two teams who are playing really attacking football. And for anyone who isn't watching Brighton on a regular basis because they're a small club or they're not one of the typical household names that you watch, I strongly recommend that next weekend you turn off Manchester United or Chelsea, turn on Brighton and see some of the football they're playing. Roberto De Zerbi is, put it like this, before the match against Liverpool, Klopp referred to Brighton as the best coached team in the world. And I think that's a fair and an insightful comment on where they are, because just on the players on the pitch, they aren't one of the better teams in the country, but every week they produce performances and they dominate the ball and they move possession around the pitch in ways that are beautiful to see and only come from hard work on the training ground and a real telepathy, a real understanding between the players and bravery. Because, you know, you've got players like Lewis Dunk who've spent their whole life playing traditional British football. And then suddenly someone like De Zerbi's come in and taught him how to play possession, how to pass out from the back, where his angles are, where his dangerous passes and safe passes are. And I think it's a real achievement for Roberto De Zerbi. Anyway, it was a great match. Going into the first half, Brighton started well. In fact, the first half, if it wasn't for a Mohamed Salah goal in the 40th minute, was basically dominated by Brighton. They played much, much stronger football. Liverpool didn't seem to be able to dominate possession or to be able to play out from the back without losing the ball to Brighton. But that goal from Salah in the 40th minute did change the game. It was a great goal. It was a great finish. And it changed the game. And then 5 minutes later, Liverpool were in front and everybody thought that Liverpool had kicked into gear and that would be it. But Brighton, being the quality outfit that they are, found a way to come back into it in the second half. And in the 78th minute, the man I spoke about earlier, Lewis Dunk, made it 2-2. And really, Tom, it was two sides going at it hammer and tong. And by that, I mean going at it with full energy, full passion. It was a really, really, really exciting match. It was one of the best games of football I've seen in a while, because often you feel that there are two teams in matches, but only one team's playing well at one time. Whereas there were points of this match where you really thought that both teams were playing their best stuff at the same time. So it was really good. It was competitive. Did you catch any of the match and what were your impressions of it?
I caught just the highlights, the goals, and I read about it because, like yourself, Tim, or as our longer term listeners will know, I have been singing the praises of Brighton for a while now. For me, it's very curious because you look on that team sheet and you think, who's this Igor, centre-back, Brazilian, 25? Who's this Carlos Baleba, 21-year-old, Cameroonian? Who's this Simon Adingra, Ivory Coast, 19 years old? Oh, sorry, Baleba's 19, Adingra's 21. You're thinking, these are very young, fresh players. Yet, they know the system that Brighton play. They come in, they do a great job. It was Adingra actually who snuck in and intercepted a pass from Van Dijk to McAllister, the ex-Brighton midfielder, to score the first goal. So you can see that these are confident players who are well coached. You've got experienced old heads like Solly March who can drop back into the left-back position for them. So whoever is in goal, whoever is starting for that Brighton team, you might not recognise the names on the team sheet, but you can be sure that De Zerbi has got them playing in a system where everyone knows what their job is. We have to remember they beat Liverpool, I believe, in the FA Cup at Brighton last season. So you could argue that they feel very extra confident when they're coming up against Liverpool.
Yeah, I mean, Brighton have just been so clever recently. I mean, I was just looking, though. Adingra came through from the Right to Dream football academy, based in Africa, in Cameroon. I think basically it's a Right to Dream academy. It collects players from Cameroon, Nigeria, Ghana, And then they sent him off to Nordsland in Sweden, which is also a club where Mitoma played as well. So you can just see how Brighton have got this structure of bringing players through, of talent scouting, that's really basically unrivaled, really. So, yeah, fair play to them. Tom, before we get into the dark topic of VAR, let's talk about turning points. And when I say a turning point, I mean either when things stop going badly and start going well, or things stop going well and start going badly. I think for the supporters of both Chelsea and Manchester United, they will be hoping for a turning point because they've both had terrible starts to the league season. As I was saying earlier, they're down in 10th and 11th in the league table. Chelsea have spent over £1 billion in the last 12 months and Manchester United aren't far behind them. So, Tom, let's talk about Chelsea first. Of course, the situation is slightly different for Chelsea because they've got a relatively new manager, Maurizio Pochettino, but they have had a terrible start to the league. And finally, they've put together two wins on the bounce. And you said on the bounce earlier, and it means consecutively. Nice expression. And more than that, they've started to find some goals because until the last 2 weeks, they've been playing quite well. Their shots on goal were quite high. Their possession statistics, their XG were all favourable, but the results weren't going their way. But in the last 2 weeks, I think four players have really started to emerge as maybe the goal threat that they could work around for the rest of the season. One is Raheem Sterling, really had a big impact in the turnaround the last weekend in the match. And also Nicholas Jackson, the big money signing from Villarreal. He scored last week. Mudryk, the extremely big money signing last January from Shakhtar Donetsk, finally scored his first goal last week. And you could tell by the way he celebrated, it was a real weight off his shoulders, which means he felt like he was really relieved of the pressure. And a player we've spoken about before on the podcast during his time at Southampton, Broja. He was on the score sheet last week. And I think a lot of Chelsea fans have been calling for him to get more starts because although he hasn't performed in a Chelsea shirt, he has in a Southampton shirt. So he does have Premier League pedigree. So, Tom, do you think this is Mauricio Pochettino's Chelsea finding their feet, finding their rhythm? Or do you think it's too soon to make a definitive judgment that Chelsea are back in the game?
I would, if we are only talking about the two league games, the 4-1 victory away at Burnley, preceded by the 2-0 victory over Fulham, then I would say, let's wait and see. It's not a turning point yet. However, the run began earlier. They also beat Brighton and Hove Albion in the League Cup 1-0. And Brighton, as we've just mentioned, are a significant team. They are a real challenge. So winning that game, I think, gave Chelsea the confidence to go on and win the next two. Normally, you would expect Chelsea to beat Burnley. You'd expect Chelsea to beat Fulham. But this season, this group of players, or actually you could argue this year, including the second half of last season, Chelsea have not been performing like a team capable of beating smaller clubs than them. So I think that this could well be the turning point for Chelsea. I still look at their team and I think I'm not sure if there's enough Premier League experience there. I agree that Armando Broja is experienced. He looked very good at Southampton. They've got Sterling, they've got Gallagher, they've got Enzo Fernandez, they've got Thiago Silva. Cucurella has reinvented himself as a right back now in this Chelsea team, stepping in for the absent Reece James, who's injured. You wonder, are these players good enough to make them a top threat? I can see them finishing in the top six or seven, but maybe not the top five for the Champions League.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I asked the question and I wrote on my notes an answer and I wrote maybe. is, are they back? Is this a turning point? It's certainly a step in the right direction. I think we can say that. Moving on to Manchester United. Is this a turning point for them? Of course, they were 1-0 down against Brentford. And they brought on Scott McTominay, who, if half the Manchester United fans had been listened to, he would have been sold in the summer, but he wasn't. He's been putting in some great performances for Scotland, and there are lots of calls for him to be played in this dysfunctional Manchester United midfield. However, he hasn't been playing. He was brought on really as a desperate measure by Erik ten Hag late in the game, and he scored two goals. A first one was a volley, and the second one was a header, and they were both good goals. And he said it was his best moment in his history of playing football. And he was a player who's come through the academy at Manchester United, so a big moment for him and fair play. However, I'm not sure that this is the turning point. The defence is still a big issue for me. I mean, just the Brentford goal as an example. I mean, a series of errors led to the goal. Casemiro gave the ball away. Victor Lindelof failed to clear after Wiese drove into the box. And then Andre Onana should have saved Matthias Jensen's shot, but he didn't. He let it kind of squirm, crawl under his body. And it's just another example of Andre Butterfingers Onana not being good enough with his hands. And if those problems can't be solved, Tom, there's no way they can compete, in my opinion. Also, not just the defence, there's no creativity in midfield. Rashford, who was one of the few shining lights in the squad last season, seems to be out of form. I heard someone say that he ran back. He tracked back like he was carrying a fridge. To track back means to run in a defensive way, not an attacking way. And, you know, there are big problems in there. You've got Casemiro, who on the one hand is their top scorer this season, which is worrying. He also looks slow and leggy in midfield. He doesn't look the player who arrived from Real Madrid. They've played Amrabat. He had two or three starts at left back. He's finally been moved into the centre of the park, and he looks like he could be the player that Manchester United have been needing. But if he's the player that Manchester United have been needing, why did they sign him on the last day of the transfer window, not the first? You know, just earlier we were saying that maybe the Chelsea results had been worse than the performances. And now that the performances, now that the results have improved, they kind of correlate with the results. I kind of think that there is a pretty strong correlation between the Manchester United performances and their results. I don't think they're playing very well, and I think the results reflect that. And also, when the manager comes out and says the players are playing well, when everyone in the stadium knows that they're not, that for me is worrying as well. When there's a disconnect between the player and fans, I think it's between the manager and the fans, I think it's very difficult to win that round, to get back control of the momentum. What do you think, Tom, about the United situation?
I think, first of all, we have to consider that this is not the first choice Man United back for. When everyone's fully fit, then you've got Wan-Bissaka at right back, you've got Luke Shaw at left back, you've got Rafael Varane, and you've got Lisandro Martinez. The goalkeeper, I don't know what went on, why they got rid of David De Gea. They had him for the best part of 10 years, but it looks like they've replaced him with someone who is clearly struggling. I don't know why Onana is struggling. It seems to be something psychological. You know, maybe he's nervous. It's big boots to fill, which is an expression meaning it's very hard to replace the previous goalkeeper. Clearly, that there's defensive weakness there. I think you're right about Rashford. I've heard some criticism that, and let's be honest, actually, looking back at Rashford over the last six or seven seasons, he blows hot and cold. When he's in form, for example, for England at the Qatar World Cup, you don't want to drop him. You want to have him starting every game. You want to have him taking all the free kicks, all the penalties. And then he blows cold, meaning that he's out of form and nothing's going right. And there's just something wrong. So there does seem to be an issue with consistency for Rashford. But I do think that Manchester United will click into gear eventually. I think Amrabat is quality, Casemiro is quality, Bruno Fernandes is quality. Rasmus Højlund is unproven at this stage, but they've got Garnacho, they've got Eriksen. Scott McTominay, how I wish that West Ham had bought him. Well, we wouldn't have had a place for him in our midfield now, but yes, I think he can still come in, and as he proved, what a great substitution that was, coming in and scoring two goals in stoppage time. I think Manchester United will turn things around. I think Ten Hag needs a bit more time.
Yeah, I think their results will improve, but I don't think they're going to challenge for the Champions League. And Tom, I'm going to stick my neck out. I know you've punished me for this one before, but I'm going to do it again. I don't think Erik Ten Hag will be the Manchester United manager for the first game of next season. I know that's a big statement, but I can smell it, Tom. I can smell it in my bones. And of course, Tom, when I say I can smell it in my bones, that's a mix of two expressions. One means I can smell it, meaning I can feel it's going to happen. And the other one, I can feel it in my bones, which also means the same, you can feel it's going to happen. And Tom, talking about instinctive feelings and what's your heart saying? What's your body saying? Let's talk about VAR, because I've got a gut feeling, which means an instinctive feeling that something's wrong with VAR. We saw last week the Liverpool against Tottenham match, really destroyed by VAR, I would say. I think it was the worst decision I can remember, but not the only one. For those people who have been living in a cave for the last 10 days, what happened was Liverpool scored a goal through Luis Diaz from a through ball from Mohamed Salah. As is the norm nowadays, the linesman allowed the play to continue. Luis Diaz scored. He then put up his flag and he said he thought it was offside, but could they review the decision? In the VAR studio, they understood that the decision had been goal. They checked it. They said, check complete. And the referee understood that that meant the check was complete and that he should continue with the on-field decision, which was offside. The check was very fast. No lines were drawn, according to the replays shown on television. The referee restarted play. Of course, the PGMOL, which is the Referees Association, released the audio, and you could hear the conversations. I imagine you've heard it, Tom. It was a bit of a disgrace, a bit of a farce. When something's a farce, it's something not serious, not something done as well or as seriously as it should be. The referee, in fact, the person who sounded like he knew most about what was going on in the audio was the technician whose job it is to control the lines and the technology. He was the only one who seemed to know what was going on. And by the time the VAR referee listened, go on, Tom, sorry.
Why was it farcical? Was it confusion between the referees in the VAR studio, or was it a miscommunication? What made it a bit of a farce?
Well, the confusion, the major confusion was the on-field decision was offside, and the VAR referees watched the video again, thinking that the on-field decision had been onside. So they essentially told the referee to stick with his decision. Instead of saying it obviously, clearly, give the goal onside, they said, stick with your decision. Check over, review finished. And then the referee, because there has been a directive from Howard Webb, the head of British English Premier League referees, to say that the VAR check should be faster if possible, and it was very fast, and the referee started play again, and the second he'd started play again, the people in the VAR, well, the technician said, no, stop the play, bring it back, it's a goal. But by that point, the rules of the game say you can't bring the game back once the play has been restarted. Everyone watching on television knew it was a goal. I imagine most people in the stadium knew it was a goal. I'm sure the Liverpool players, Luis Diaz, knew it was a goal. I'm sure Cristiano Romero, who played him on side, knew it was a goal. But some crucial people didn't know it was a goal, and that was the referee and the people in the VAR studio. I have to say, Tom, this wasn't the referee's fault. He reviewed the images and they gave him the wrong information. It was an absolute joke. But Tom, VAR's been brought in to make football better. And to make decisions more correct. Now, I don't think either has happened because football is now slower. We're now stopping for all sorts. And in fact, the pauses in the game are less in the Premier League than in Spanish football. In Spanish football, they're really destroying the flow of the game. So are they making the spectacle better? No. Sometimes you can lose momentum. The match loses its energy after a 2 or 3 minute pause for a VAR revision. And secondly, they wanted to make decisions more accurate. And I don't know the exact percentages, but it seemed to me before VAR, there was a percentage of big decisions that were clearly wrong. And now with VAR, there's a percentage of big decisions that are clearly wrong. So my question really, Tom, I've got some solutions and we can talk about solutions. But my question really, Tom, is VAR making football better? If there is an increase in quality of decision making, is that minor increase worth all of the pauses? And of course, the fact that the disconnect between the fans in the stadium who have no idea what's going on, who can't see the replays, who don't know why the decision's been changed. Is it worth it, Tom? Or should we just go back, maybe keep the black and white decisions like goal line technology and in theory offside and get rid of the decisions for fouls and for things like that? And we could also discuss the Curtis Jones red card, the Kovacic red card that didn't happen this week. Tom, is it worth it or should we just scrap it, get rid of it and go back to proper football how it used to be?
I think we have to stick with it, Tim. I think that the proper football, how it used to be as an England fan, involves, you know, Diego Maradona's hand of God, or it involves Frank Lampard's goal that clearly crossed the line and would have given us a 2-2 draw against Germany at halftime.
Don't go down that path if any Germans are listening from 1966, yeah. Tom, keep that quiet. Yes.
So I think that what happens here with VAR is something. There's a phenomenon they call the Streisand effect. It was named after the singer Barbara Streisand, who decided that she wanted to employ the police and lawyers to prevent her property in Florida from being in the spotlight, having camera attention put on it. But because of all the effort and the work that she went to try and stop her property being filmed and photographed, it created more of an effect. It attracted more attention. So the Streisand effect is the phenomenon that you take action to stop something happen and more comes as a result. I feel with VAR, it's similar because VAR was brought in to eliminate these problems. So when they do still continue to happen, they do attract more attention, particularly from the commentarati, all of those studio pundits that we see whose job it is to talk about controversial moments very, very strongly and say, we should just scrap VAR. We should go back to the way it used to be. You know, I appreciate that this kind of soundbite gets newspaper headlines and it gets clicks on the internet. But we have to also accept that probably with a team in the VAR studio, most times, more often than not, you have that backup, which will mean that those mistakes that can change the course and the result of a game, they will happen less with a team there. I do agree with you on the point that it does put delays into the game. The most frustrating one is when a player scores the goal. It dampers the initial excitement. To dampen or damper means to, you know, it stops a player getting too excited too early. So there's not that euphoric celebration with the fans usually. Then there's a delayed celebration where it's a little bit anticlimactic. I appreciate that's the downside of VAR. But I think we also have to accept that we've VAR is a technology, but it is operated by humans. As you described very, very well what happened in Tottenham and Liverpool, there was clearly a mistake with communication. Someone in the studio thought that the referee had given a goal, the referee had given an offside. That's human error. We are humans. We will learn from these mistakes. Maybe the language will now change, that it will be more explicitly stated, that was offside or that was onside, that was a goal. These things, there will be steady improvements over time in the technology, but there will always be human error. There will still be mistakes with VAR. And when those mistakes happen, we can expect a media circus to go on around it.
Yeah. I mean, imagine being people who made a living talking about football and controversies. It must be an awful, awful distance, Tom. I don't know how we survive. Tom, I've got some solutions. I agree with you. I think there is no way to go back. We must go forward. And VAR has the potential to be better. So, Tom, I've got some solutions for you, and I want to talk you through them, and you tell me if you like them or if you don't like them. Okay? Number one, you've already touched upon it, which means to mention it briefly, better communication. I don't think that the referees should have to say check complete or something like that. I think they should talk to each other like humans. If you watch rugby, the VAR system in rugby, it works very well. You can hear the VAR official and the referee having a conversation in real time. You can hear them having doubts and arriving at conclusions using logic, just in the same way commentators would do watching the images, just in the same way you and I might do sitting in the living room watching them together. So I think it makes it a much more human interaction and less robotic. And because it's not robotic, it would allow them a greater range of responses. I think the limited responses to say check over, check not over, or also when they're reviewing decisions, they're reviewing them very specifically. They're saying was there contact, or you know, they should ask like they do in rugby, is there any reason why I can't give this goal? That's a much better question, because then they can watch it with open eyes, with unprejudiced eyes. So, Tom, what do you think? Just first, I've got other solutions as well, but just on this aspect, allowing more freer communication, allowing them to arrive at a decision together. Do you think it's a good idea or a bad idea?
I wholeheartedly concur with that one. I think, as you mentioned, rugby is an excellent model for football to try and copy.
Yeah. Okay. To concur, a very nice way of saying to agree. Tom, a second one, which I've heard suggested, is an ex-professional football player in the VAR studio with a referee and the tech guy, the IT guy. The idea that this would bring in some football common sense. You often hear professionals with an understanding of the game that even like football lovers like me or you don't have. You hear comments like, oh, you know, he left something in on that tackle, meaning he tried to tackle the person in a way that would cause them pain. And you often see little insights that the normal person doesn't have. However, saying that, having said that, I think a lot of ex-football players would potentially referee the game that they want to see, not the referee the game according to the official rules. So maybe they would think, for example, a person who's played in the 80s might want more physicality or something like that. Tom, what do you think about the idea of having an ex-pro in the studio with the other people?
No, I think ex-pros have enough jobs already in the world of football punditry and commentary. It seems to be a very nice gig for ex-players. I don't believe that an ex-player can offer any insight that a technician or someone who has studied and followed football very closely, but more as a spectator, something they wouldn't be able to offer. So I don't think an ex... And I also agree with your point that an ex-player will bring in their own bias according to the kind of player that they were or according to how they would like to see the game played. So, no, I disagree with that suggestion.
Okay. Third suggestion. Currently, the referees who are on the pitch and in the VAR studio are the same people, and they're rotated. Sometimes they're on the pitch, sometimes they're in the VAR studio. And I think that they're very different jobs, and potentially we should have a specialized group of VAR referees. And I think there should be a much reduced group. I think of all the football matches that happen at any one point in England, I think we could be talking about maybe three or four people who are always the VAR referees. Think on a Saturday afternoon when there are five or six matches at the same time. Okay, so that would be the minimum. That would be the number you would have to have. The amount of people matching the highest amount of games at any one time. But always have those people in the VAR studios, specifically train them for that job. And also, because they would be specific VAR studio referees, maybe there would be less pressure on the on-pitch referee to agree with the VAR studio decision. But more than that, they would just be specialised in that job. They would be accustomed to the technology. They would be kind of halfway between the IT guy who's currently in there and the referee. Tom, what do you think? Keep the on-field referees on the pitch and maybe have a younger, more technologically savvy group of people in the VAR studio. To be tech savvy means to know and understand and like technology. What do you think, Tom?
I agree with the part about keeping the on-field referees on the pitch. I don't see them offering anything extra in the studio that couldn't be provided by another person. I don't agree with limiting the number so much. I do agree that it is a highly specialized position, but I don't want it to be a closed shop. I don't want it to us to create an elite group of technicians who command a disproportionate amount of power or influence or money because they're the only ones who are allowed to do the job. I think that we should have a wide talent pool, and we should be training lots of people to become skilled in this specialist job of working in the VAR studio.
Okay. Fourth proposal. What about changing the dynamic, changing the pressures on the referee? And when they're called over to the screen to watch the images again, somehow communicate it in such a way where the referees feel freer to back their on-field decision. Currently, I think in the history of VAR in the Premier League, there's been one time when the referee has watched the television images again and disagreed with the VAR and stuck with their original decision. So do you think maybe the language should be changed? Instead of saying, oh, I think you've got this one wrong, can you come and check? I think it's a dangerous tackle. Maybe they could say, this is worthy of review. To be worthy of something means to deserve it, or just change the mentality. Say to referees, look, we want you to disagree with us as long as you can justify it. And maybe they could watch the image and justify why they're sticking with their decision. And then later in the week, when that audio is released, people would know. Do you think that could be it, Tom? Because at the moment, when the referee makes the symbol with his hands and says he's going to watch the images, we know they're changing their decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm not sure if changing the language, the wording, the style of communication will result in referees standing by their original decisions more. I'm not entirely sure. I'm not entirely convinced that referees should but stand by their original decisions. I still think that the VAR studio with a team of people is more likely to give a better judgment on what happened than the referee on the pitch, who might not always have the best angle or the best view. I think the way the system is set up, regardless of the language, if the referee receives that message in his ear and he makes that TV screen sign, then it's very likely that the referee is going to change his decision, regardless of how the communication between the referee and the VAR studio changes.
So before my next point, I've got something to come back then. So if the referees aren't changing their decision, what's the point in them going to see the images? If they're just always going with the VAR decision, then when the VAR says you've made the wrong decision, save 2 minutes, stop the pauses in the game and just say, OK, we trust the VAR referee. I think half of the problem with VAR is that we're trying to protect old values. So the idea of not wanting to re-referee the match, not wanting to devalue the importance of the on-field referee seems to me ridiculous. When we are devaluing him by bringing in VAR. And I also think this, I mean, for the Liverpool match last week, this protected by God rule that you can't pull play back. Well, we've already stopped lots of God-given things in football, like the game should flow to include VAR. So I think once we've broken that, then break it a little bit more and get the right decision. So, Tom, what do you think? 4.1, I've got my fifth proposal, but 4.1 proposal, scrap the TV replays and just trust the VAR. And then we'd save a bit of time and save a bit of controversy.
I think you're describing a modification that might well be in place in 5 or 10 years. I expect we might have a couple of seasons more of tweaking VAR, of getting the system smoother and more effective and error-proof. But then I expect what you've just described, skipping the referee, not having the referee go over to review the screen. I expect that football will be that way in 10 years' time.
Okay. Next one, Tom, my fifth proposal. And this really comes from the Curtis Jones red card against Tottenham for Liverpool, was when the referees called over to see the images. I think the way they're presented these images really conditions their response. So when the referee was called over in the Liverpool match, the first image he was shown was a freeze frame. It was like a photo of Curtis Jones's studs in Bissouma's shin. And then so when you see that image, you think, wow, that's got to be a red card. But and then they show various images and you see the whole tackle. But the way that first image was presented made me feel, oh, he's going to give a red card here. And then there were three images of the tackle, and two of them I don't think show the extenuating circumstances in the Jones tackle, and one of them does. And the two images that were more incriminating, which means to make him look guilty, were shown at least three or four times. And the one image which maybe showed how his foot bounced up off the ball and therefore took it a little bit further towards Bissouma's leg, and because of the ball, the contact was initiated, that was only shown once. And also, all of them were shown in slow motion. None of them were shown in full speed. So my proposal is the first images that the ref sees should be in full speed, and he should see all of the angles in full speed before the slow motion before the slow motion images are shown. Because I think then that would allow the referee to feel what they felt when they saw it in real time, and to therefore trust their instincts a bit more. And I don't think the use of freeze frames is useful in a dynamic mobile sport. So, Tom, what do you think about this getting rid of freeze frames, showing the replays in real time first and not depending on slow motion so much?
Yes, I think it would be good to have a protocol perhaps of how they compile the compilation of clips, the different angles of the controversial incidents. It would be good to standardize it so that there's less opportunity for something to be made to be worse than it in effect was. I'm not entirely convinced, Tim, that it would make much difference. I think if you are capturing all the different angles, if the referee does have a chance to see the different angles in real speed and in slow motion, then I think he's getting a comprehensive view of the controversial incident.
Okay, so Tom, they are my proposals. You've batted them all away. It looks like we're doomed to another 5 years of farcical decisions. Not farcical, farcical. So Tom, a question I am left with when I see this VAR situation constantly is, define to me, Tom, what is a clear and obvious error? Because when I watched the Curtis Jones tackle, I thought it wasn't a red card. I thought it was a yellow card. Lots of my friends also thought it was a yellow card. I heard Robbie Savage and Chris Sutton on BBC 606 sure that it was a red card. So for me, I don't think this was a clear and obvious error because there's a lot of disagreement about it. And I think you could also say the same with the Kovacic decision when he wasn't sent off because... I mean, to me, it was a clear and obvious error. And everyone I spoke to agreed with me. But I must admit, a lot of the people I spoke to were Arsenal fans. But when clear and what is clear and obvious? For me, clear and obvious should be, oh, I didn't think he made contact and he did make contact. Or I thought he was in control of his body, but you can see in the image he's got 2 feet off the ground. Or I thought it didn't touch his arm, but it did touch his arm. I think there should be really black and white decisions. They shouldn't be interpretation, because the whole idea of VAR was brought in to fix clear and obvious errors, and I don't think it's being used for that. I think it is actually being used in pursuit of what we might call the correct decision. So Tom, do you think that's a problem of definition? Do you think we should get rid of this idea of a clear and obvious error and just be honest with what VAR is, and that is a way to re-referee the match? Or do you think we should stick with it and allow the on-field and basically trust the on-field decisions more unless there is something which is clear and obvious?
The phrase clear and obvious reminds me of the idiom to try and put a square peg in a round hole. The square peg in this case being the clear and obvious language. Yes, and the round hole being football, the nature of the sport, particularly at premier elite level, means that you have professional players playing right up to the margins between fair play and foul play. That's where the advantage can be gained or lost. Matches and opportunities can be taken or not taken. So to try and use this language, clear and obvious, about a sport where there's so much grey area, there's so much shade around so many decisions, so many tackles, so many incidents. I think that the problem is with the wording, it's with the language. Maybe we need to accept that, yes, it's the wrong choice of words. Or if we want to say clear and obvious, then we've got to accept that it's not going to be clear and obvious for everyone.
Yeah, okay. But you can see why the way things are at the moment, you can see why it frustrates supporters. You know, when I'm in my WhatsApp groups watching Arsenal, Manchester City, and everyone's saying, you know, this is a clear and obvious error and they haven't changed the decision. Everyone's comparing it to last week and it's totally different. The biggest issue here, of course, is consistency and the lack of it between two games, even in the same game. Tom, final question. It's not about VAR, but it is about referees. And you know I like a conspiracy. Tom, what do you think about Michael Oliver refereeing in Abu Dhabi the week of Manchester City Arsenal, paid by the Abu Dhabi state, the same people who own Manchester City? Do you think there is a conflict of interests here, like a lot of my friends online think? Or do you think that people like Michael Oliver are able to separate huge amounts of money coming into their bank account with crucial decisions on a Saturday afternoon?
I think a referee like Michael Oliver or any elite level referee becomes elite level because they are able to separate any kind of bias from going out on the pitch and refereeing in an instinctive way. They have to rely on their instincts and call it as they see it in the moment, you know, in the split second that it happens. So I think that's a conspiracy for Arsenal fans to sink their teeth into, particularly. Was he the referee who didn't give the red card to Kovacic?
Yes.
I see. Yes, I think that one will have to go back onto the conspiracy pipeline. You need your tinfoil hat for that one.
Yeah, well, Tom, you say it'll be the Arsenal fans, you know, but Liverpool fans last week, they had Darren England and Dan Cook. who did them over against Tottenham, and to do somebody over means to treat them badly. And these referees had had made a 6-hour flight back from United Arab Emirates the day before the Liverpool match. And there isn't talk of conspiracy here, but there is talk of jet lag, of being overworked. And I think there is a bigger question here. And that question is, the Premier League, with all the money that exists in the English football ecosystem, do you not think we should be able to pay our referees enough at the top level that they can dedicate themselves to the Premier League and almost treat their mind and their body like a player would treat their mind and a body? You know, match preparation, match recovery, match preparation, match, and think about nothing else. I personally think that it's not a great image for the Premier League to have its referees going all around the world for big money, working and on Fridays and then coming back and doing Premier League matches on Saturdays. What do you think about that, Tom?
I think that, yes, certainly we can pay these players handsomely enough. We can tweak the conditions in their contracts so they are only exclusively employed and can only do work for the Premier League, which means no moonlighting in Abu Dhabi. Moonlighting, of course, means finding a side gig, an extra job. Yes, I think that can be changed, that can be arranged. But I don't see it as a big problem at this stage, but you know, perhaps in the future it could be.
Okay, Tom. I think we've put the world to rights in terms of VAR and football and referees. To put the world to rights means to have a conversation with your friend about life and to consider that the world's problems have been solved. So, Tom, it's International Week this week. We've got a big match between Spain and Scotland. Big consequences for qualifying for the group. We've got England, Australia, England, Italy, and of course, in other news, the retirement today of Eden Hazard. Great player in England, a bit of a sick note in La Liga, though. Tom, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast. We'll see you soon. See you next time. And thanks for listening, everyone.
Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.